I have a great pleasure to introduce you Finland distinguished Professor Martin Hager. Martin Hager holds PhD degrees in exercise psychology from Loughborough University, United Kingdom, and sport, exercise and health sciences from the University of Jyväskylä. He is currently John Curtin Distinguished Professor and Director of the Health Psychology and Behavioral Medicine Research Group in the School of Psychology and Speech Pathology at Curtin University, Perth, Australia. He is also Editor-in-Chief of Health Psychology Review and Stress and Health, and editorial board member of several peer-reviewed journals. Martin Hager on maailman johtavia motivaatio- ja käyttäytymisen muutostutkijoita. Suomessa toteutettavan tutkimushankkeen tavoitteena on kehittää motivaatioteorioihin perustuvia lähestymistapoja elämän muutokseen ja fyysisen aktiivisuuden edistämiseen. Martin is an international guy. He has lived in Australia, South Africa, Singapore, England, and now Finland. He has athlete background with a favorite of triathlon and marathon. And his best time in marathon is 2 hours, 42 minutes. We are delighted and honored to have you here with us, Martin. Please, the floor is yours.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be asked to talk to you today. It's always nice to come and address an audience in Finland because I often go to international congresses and people are always speaking in their second language, and I know that people in Finland speak excellent English, so it's always a pleasure. And my Finnish is not so good, I'm sorry to say. So I'm going to just wrestle with the technology. Bear with me for a second. So, thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you very much for the very very nice introduction. So, I work at Curtin University in Perth, in Western Australia, and I am a health psychologist, and I head up the Health Psychology and Behavioral Medicine Research Group, which is in Western Australia. So the wild west of Australia. And that is really what it's like all of the time. So I specifically designed this slide to make you jealous, okay? And here is a vista of Curtin University and its surroundings. So you can see that Curtin is a very remote university. It's actually in Western Australia. It's one of the most remote cities in Perth, one of the most remote cities in the world. But we have very nice surroundings. Here are some students in their natural environment. And this is our new medical school. So we're very proud to be the first university to receive the government funding for a medical school in 50 years. So we're very proud of that. It's always nice to come to Finland, though, because you have so much water. Western Australia is extremely dry. So it's nice to come over and see how much water you have, and I hope you can send it to us. Okay, so I'm a health psychologist, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about the psychology behind changing people's behavior. But I'm hoping to make links between how those psychological methods that we use to change behavior can link to education and changing behavior in educational settings. This is an overview of what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this notion of self-regulation, so getting people to change behavior for themselves and why it's important. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about how psychological theory can help. I'm going to introduce to you this idea of an integrated behavior change model. So this presents some ideas drawn from psychological theory as to how we can develop interventions to effectively change people's behavior. I'm going to talk a little bit about motivation and intention, volition and planning, and also some more recent research on implicit processes and how that impacts on people's behavior. I'll talk a little bit about how that has been translated and applied to understanding health behavior and behavior more broadly in terms of behavior change. I'll then summarize and talk a little bit about the way forward. And if you have any questions, we can take them at the end. But if you have any questions as we're going through, then I'm more than happy to answer them. Okay, so let's start with this notion, this idea of self-regulation. So I entitled my talk, The Psychology of Self-Regulation and the Psychology of Changing Behavior. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what self-regulation is and the key features of changing behavior. So if you want to try and change someone's behavior, and we're often in the position where we want to do that because many of the problems that we experience in society are associated with people not doing things that they should or doing too much of the things that they shouldn't. Okay? And so in the context of health behavior, for example, people drink too much, they eat too much, they don't do enough physical activity, and of course we still have problems with smoking, although I know in Finland that levels of smoking are not as high as they are in other nations in the world. But changing those behaviors will result in significant changes in adaptive and health-promoting outcomes. So changing those behaviors may result in increased longevity, increased life expectancy, reduced levels of obesity, diabetes, many of the cardiovascular disease, cancer, many of the chronic diseases that are problematic. And of course, that will have knock-on implications for costs to health services and to governments. So changing behavior is very high on the agenda for health professionals, for educationalists, and for governments and policymakers. So the key features of changing behavior from a psychological perspective, and if you want to try and get people to change behavior, you need to raise their awareness that they have a problem or that their behavior could lead to problems later on. So raising awareness of behavior change is important. But of course, people won't change their behavior unless there are advantages to them. So you need to provide them with a clear rationale as to why they should change, and that will usually involve getting them to appreciate the benefits of changing and to downplay the costs or the problems with changing. One of the many reasons why people don't change their behavior is because many of the behaviors, the behaviors which are maladaptive that they do, are rewarding, very rewarding. You know, unhealthy food tastes good. You know, smoking has chemical, biochemical changes in the brain which are rewarding. And so many of the behaviors that we do that may be health compromising are quite rewarding. And so the benefits, according to those people, outweigh the costs. So changing behavior requires a level of effort and motivation. And therefore, the costs, the benefits really need to be emphasized in order for people to mobilize their resources to change behavior. And of course, people need to know how they can change. So they need to know the skills and the techniques or the strategies that they can use to change those behavior. Because many of the behaviors are ingrained, they've been practiced and they've been habituated over a long period of time. So it takes a lot of effort to break those habits. So self-regulation is about getting people to change their behavior, to change their own behavior, to regulate or manage their behavior. So in short, it's about helping people to change behavior for themselves. So why is self-regulation important? Well, I've already outlined some of the issues around the importance of self-regulation. So prevention of chronic illness and promoting adaptive outcomes requires people to engage in goal-directed behaviors over extended period of time and refrain from others. And I've given you some examples previously. And this is, of course, challenging because those behaviors, as I intimated earlier, are impulsive. Okay, so they're related to biological tendencies. They're very rewarding, so they've been strongly reinforced over time, and therefore they are habitual. So they're learned over time, and they're also reinforced by the circumstances under which people perform those behaviors. So, for example, smokers' behavior may be reinforced by the fact that there's a chemical addiction. But there's also good research demonstrating that smoking is also extremely strongly reinforced by context. So what that means is smokers tend to take up and tend to enact their behavior in situations, in key situations. So smokers often smoke, you know, after a meal, first thing in the morning, with a coffee, and in social situations where there are other smokers. So those situations cue up and reinforce that behavior. So breaking that habit and those cues is actually very challenging because those cues are naturally presented to those people on a regular basis. So here are some examples of outcomes that are related to poor self-regulation. So people who are unable to regulate their behavior in particular behaviors in particular contexts. So you can see many health behaviors are there, but also other behaviors less related to health, but also maladaptive from a behavioral point of view. People who are good at self-regulating, however, are more likely to have adaptive behavioral outcomes. So people who have good self-regulation are more likely to be successful in school, the workplace, more likely to have cohesive personal relationships, good health, of course, and they're also well-equipped to cope with difficulties and barriers. So having good self-regulation is an attribute and a set of characteristics which are very beneficial in terms of being functional and adaptive in everyday life. So what makes a person good at self-regulation? There are a number of psychological factors that have been identified in the literature and have been demonstrated to be associated with these adaptive behaviors. So positive attitudes and beliefs, as you might expect, are related to engaging in particular health behaviors. And of course, having good motivation, strong reasons and rationales for changing are clearly important. And that's related to people's intentions to change their behavior or to engage in those kinds of behaviors. The more you intend to do a particular behavior, the more likely you are to do it. It keys you up to doing that behavior. As I mentioned before in the smoking example, social influences are also clearly important. So our environment clearly influences our behavior. And there are pressures, of course, to engage in certain behaviors. And some of the behaviors that I outlined earlier are very much related to the social pressures that people are put under. And that's particularly true in educational settings, as many of you will be aware, that social pressure, particularly amongst young people, clearly influences their behavior. And the desire to conform and the desire to engage in certain behaviors tends to be reinforced by social context. But then, of course, you can also use that, and we as people who are interested in behavior change can also use that as a means to change behavior. So social support for behavior change can be a powerful resource in terms of changing behavior. Getting people to be aware of their behavior and to monitor their own behavior is also very important when it comes to self-regulation and motivating behavior change. So if a person is effective in monitoring the kinds of behaviors that they engage in and basically becoming aware of the times and the situations where they may lapse if they're trying to change their behavior, or the situations where they engage in behaviors which are undesirable, is related to behavior change. They are much more able to engage in changes in their behavior if the people are aware and can monitor the times where they might lapse. And that's very much related to a person's self-control. And so a person who is able to control or regulate their behavior is much more effective in doing so. So self-control is clearly important. We shouldn't deny, of course, that personality and individual differences also affect our behavior. The context seems to be more important, at least that's what the evidence suggests, but you cannot deny the fact that there are people who have individual differences and tendencies, personality variables. And these can be things like the big five, so you know, conscientiousness, openness to experience, neuroticism, and so forth, can affect people's behavior. But it can also be individual differences in preference and cognitive styles. So it may be people are more open to messages if they have a certain cognitive style, a certain learning style. And many of you will be familiar with those kinds of styles. And, of course, cues and prompts in the environment may also be effective in assisting people to self-regulate. So structuring the environment so that it makes it easier for people to engage in behaviors which are desirable, but also making it more difficult to engage in behaviors which are undesirable is clearly very important. Okay? So banning smoking in public places is an excellent example of structuring the environment and removing a cue to that behavior or minimizing the cues to that behavior. People are less likely, of course, they can't smoke, but they're less likely to engage or experience or encounter the cues to that behavior. So what do interventions to change behavior look like? Well, there are a number of situations and a number of means by which we can get messages across to people to effectively change their behavior. And so one of the means to do so would be to use media. Okay, and so persuasive communications developed based on the psychological research can help persuade people and encourage people to change their behavior. And actually, advertising agents and people who are involved in marketing are well ahead in this regard. So people who market products and people who market people who market things that we will purchase in a commercial sense are very much aware of the power of persuasive communication in the media to change behavior. Psychologists are becoming much more aware of those techniques, and they are beginning to use that to market social ideas, to market persuasive communications about changing behavior. And those kinds of messages can be delivered in advertisements, so things like TV advertisements, posters, and so forth. Print communication, so leaflets and booklets, which are presented in the desired context, and which can be very effective if managed correctly. Of course, social media, web-based interventions, instructional materials, training manuals are all means by which we can get messages to people. And then, of course, the context is important, and there are other means to get messages across. So in educational settings, it may be one-on-one or a leader delivering an intervention to a group. Okay? So things like clinician communication, motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy would be examples of delivery of interventions by an individual. So those are the kinds of things I'm talking about when I talk about interventions. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to talk a little bit about psychological theory, why it's important, and how it can inform these kinds of behavior change interventions. So I'll talk a little bit about psychological theory. Don't worry if the last time that you did psychological theory was way back, in school. I'll take you through psychology 101, and it won't be too technical, all right? So in my view, and in the view of many psychologists, theory is important to inform interventions. It provides us with a basis to answer the what's and the how questions when it comes to the factors that influence behavior and behavior change. So basically, theory is just a way of explaining things and outcomes. So they're explanatory systems. And in the context of behavior change, identifying the personal and social factors, so the, answering the what questions, that are associated with behavior, and if we can identify those and identify with, that they're strongly related to behavior, then if we can assume that those factors are manipulable or changeable, then changing those factors will result in a concomitant change in behavior. Another advantage of theory is that it provides us with the mechanisms responsible. So it not only identifies the what factors, but it also identifies the mechanisms and processes that are involved. And that provides us with targets for intervention. So we know what impacts on behavior, we know how they impact on behavior, we can then change those factors and hopefully evoke a change in behavior. Theory is also important because it helps us with research. It helps us come up with the evidence and the basis that can inform interventions, that can inform our efforts to change behavior. Otherwise, the efforts become a little bit of a stab in the dark. They become a little bit of guesswork, variable fishing expeditions, hit and hope type approaches, which involve people saying, well, I think this might work in changing behavior. But actually many behavior change interventions have used this approach. And then people wonder why they're not effective. It's because they're not based on evidence and they're not based on theory. So sometimes those interventions may work, okay, and sometimes people may get it right, but you wouldn't know how they worked without a systematic approach, without a theory-based and an evidence-based approach. People who have studied psychology will probably be aware that psychology is an extremely theory-rich discipline. So we have lots of theories, and sometimes it's difficult to put a finger on what theory to adopt when trying to study and understand behavior. And this is just an example of some of the theories that I'm aware of and that have been used to study health behavior. Some of you will be familiar with some of these theories. And this is not an exhaustive list. There are many others. Okay, so we have a theory-rich discipline. Making sense of these theories actually presents a problem. It presents a problem when it comes to trying to understand health behavior, but it also presents a problem, particularly when you're trying to design and develop interventions. What theory do you use? Which one is the best? Which one is the most appropriate? That's actually a question that hasn't really been answered within the psychological literature and presents a serious challenge. So one of the approaches that we've taken is to try and integrate and synthesize those theories so we can come up with a framework or an idea which is based on the theories that have been put forward and to try and strip down those theories to their basic components that are sufficient and parsimonious, in other words, sufficiently simple, but not too simple in that we are reducing a rather complex problem into two simple elements. So basically, this is our attempt to come up with a framework for understanding behavior derived from multiple theories. So it's not a new theory, it's not a new model, it's just an idea. And we've developed it in the area of physical activity, but it has applications to many other theories, sorry, many other contexts. And we see this as a flexible framework. In other words, this is not a theory of everything. It's a means to try to understand the kinds of theories that have been used and use that as a basis for developing interventions for behavior change. And so we put this forward and they proposed this in a particular research article, and one of our conclusions was that this is an opportunity to or a means to try and guide interventions. So it's not really an attempt to try and come up with a new theory. So this is the integrated behavior change model we've come up with. And it's a flexible framework that involves three different processes. And I'll just walk you through those processes. Psychologists are extremely fond of these box and arrow diagrams. Okay, so you speak to a psychologist, they will probably have one of these in their mind, probably even when they're talking to you. Okay, and basically all these diagrams are is an attempt to try and understand process and mechanism. So these boxes represent psychological variables. They represent ways in which we can measure these variables, usually through surveys and questionnaires. And the assumption is that people who respond to questionnaires on these kinds of factors or constructs can reliably report their beliefs, their attitudes, their internal workings. And so, and those are related to measures of behavior. In this case, I put down exercise behavior, but it could be any particular behavior. So the integrated behavior change model has three separate processes. One of them is a motivational process. So that's talking about how people weigh up the pros and the cons and the benefits and detriments of doing a particular behavior. It has a volitional phase or a volitional aspect, which is all about planning and converting motivation into actual behavior. It also has a more implicit aspect, a more automatic aspect, which is tries to reflect engaging in behaviors beyond a person's awareness. And actually, many times, the behaviors that we do are queued up. They are set into motion automatically without our awareness by cues, by well-learned cues. And so sometimes we end up doing things without really realizing them. You know, so how often have you realized, have you gone into a room and realized you've done that sort of automatically because you've been cued or queued up to do that behavior? So what I'm going to do is outline each of these different aspects. So I'm going to first focus on the motivational aspects and outline their relevance to changing behavior. So the inspiration, really, for the motivational component of this theory is the theories of reason, action, and planned behavior. Many of you will probably be familiar with this. And it's a much maligned theory, but it's basically a theory of attitudes and beliefs. And the idea is that people's behavior is a function of their intentions. So if you intend to do something, and these would be the kinds of questions you might ask a person to estimate their behavior. So a person's estimation of whether they will do a behavior in the future reflects their motivation, is the most proximal predictor or influence on their behavior. And intentions are a function of three different sets of beliefs. So if you believe that the behavior is something that is positive, good for you to do, useful, and beneficial, you're more likely to do that behavior. So it's basically a person's beliefs that the behavior is a good thing to do, is instrumental, and will result in outcomes that are important. You're more likely to do that behavior. Intentions are also a function of social influences. So people's beliefs that people who are important to them want them to do the behavior. So if you think your mum and dad, your friends, your colleagues, your peers want you to do a particular behavior, that reflects your subjective norm, your social influence on behavior. And then there's a control-related components, and these are beliefs about whether you can do the behavior. So it's very closely aligned to self-efficacy, and it reflects a person's capacity, beliefs in their capability of doing the behavior, and whether they can overcome barriers to do the behavior. Those three sets of beliefs set up or influence a person's intentions and mediate the effect of those beliefs. And intentions mediate the effect of those beliefs on behavior. Another inspiration, another influential theory for the integrated behavior change model is self-determination theory. Many of you will be familiar with this theory because it is quite influential within educational contexts. And basically, it outlines It's a theory of it's known as the theory of intrinsic motivation, and it outlines the quality of motivation related to behavior. So basically, more intrinsic motivation, which reflects engaging in the behavior for out of choice, or more self-determined motives, so engaging in the behavior because it will service positive outcomes, outcomes which are personally relevant, means that a person is more likely to engage in that behavior. Autonomous, self-determined motivation is much more adaptive because people will engage in the behavior for no external reinforcement. They'll do it for themselves, so it's very much important for self-regulation. And it also means there's no external contingency. Whereas more non-self-determined reasons for engaging in the behavior, so these kinds of perceptions, these kinds of beliefs, are motivating, but they're only motivating in the sense that insofar as the reinforcing contingencies are present. So, for example, a person will be externally motivated or extrinsically motivated if they are rewarded for doing that behavior, or if they do the behavior to avoid some sort of punishment or contingency. Now, a person will be motivated to engage in that behavior, but only insofar as those external contingencies are present. Once they're removed, a person will desist. Which basically means if you want to get people to do things for themselves, you would really like them to be autonomously or self-determined motivated, more intrinsically motivated. And we've integrated that into the integrated model. And this is based on some empirical research that we've done. And this is just a path analysis looking at the relationships between these factors. In this case, it was young people's beliefs about their physical activity, their motivation to engage in physical activity, their intentions and behavior to engage in physical activity in the future. And clearly you can see that self-determined motives are related to attitudes and perceptions of control in particular, and those two sets of beliefs influence intentions, which impact on behavior. So that means that basically if people feel that the behavior is personally relevant, that they want to do the behavior out of a sense of choice, and that it services personally relevant goals, they're more likely to align their beliefs and their attitudes and perceptions of control with that behavior, they're more likely to intend to do that behavior, and they're more likely to engage in that behavior in the future. So this is what they call what we have called a motivational sequence. So changing these kinds of factors may impact on motivation or intentions and may change behavior. That's the upshot of this kind of model. So really, this is where we should be directing our behavior change efforts. How do we change attitudes, control, self-determined motives so that we can change people's intentions and their behavior? So that sort of outlines the sort of motivational side of things. Okay, so I'm going to move further on and talk a little bit about this volitional phase. Okay, so research has suggested that motivation is important, clearly, for behavior. So those kinds of factors like attitudes and self-determined motivation are clearly important. But some people have argued that that's not enough. So basically, motivation may be a necessary but not sufficient condition for people to engage in behaviors. Many people intend to do behaviors, have a motive or desire to engage in particular behaviors like physical activity, but they fail to do so. Okay? So how many times have you stated an intention to go out and do some exercise or to refrain from eating unhealthily or to cut down on your alcohol intake or to be kinder and nicer to your peers and your relatives, or to walk to work instead of taking your car and so forth, but stated that intention but failed to do so. For another good example is New Year's resolutions. So after the new year, you've had a few drinks perhaps, you've perhaps eaten quite a lot, and then you say, all right, it's a new year, I am motivated, I intend to do all of these good things. I tend to be good with respect to my health behaviors. But then reality kicks in, you go back to work, and your good intentions go astray. And researchers call this the intention behavior gap. And that's because this relationship, so this is a path coefficient, looking at the relationship between intentions and exercise behavior in a very large sample of individuals. And this is a significant but small to medium effect size. So what that means is, you know, this is scaled from 0 to 1. So the closer the effect to the value of 1, the stronger the relationship. But that's not very close to 1. In fact, it's not very close to a large effect size, which would be around 0.70. Okay, so that would be a much larger effect. So this is a modest effect. It's imperfect. In other words, it means that people don't do what they intend to do. And this has been noted in a number of research articles. Okay, so here's a couple of examples. And this particular article, looking at the intention behavior gap, looked at studies that had measured people's intentions and measured their behavior and looked at the association or the link. And what they found was, when they cross-tabulated people who intended versus people who were successful or unsuccessful for doing the behavior, they found that, sure enough, yeah, there were quite a few people, 42% of people reporting their intentions and their behavior had a strong relationship between those two. So they were successful in enacting their intentions. Okay? And they're called successful intenders. Worryingly, though, from a behavior change perspective, there are also quite a lot of people who intended to do the behavior but were unsuccessful in doing so. Okay, so 36% of people. So that means that people stated a motivation and seemed to want to change but didn't change for whatever reason. And that's an important observation. And that might be the reason why the relationship between intentions and behavior is imperfect. There are also people, of course, who don't intend to do anything, and sure enough, they don't do anything. Then there's kind of a weird group who don't intend to do something, and they're actually successful in doing something. So I'm not sure how you explain that one. But it's a small percentage. But these are the people we're particularly interested in, okay? So who are those people who... How can we get those people who intend to do the behavior but don't do it to engage in behavior change? So one really, really effective, or seemingly effective and very promising approach that has been put forward in the last 15 or 20 years is planning interventions, particularly this notion of implementation intentions or action plans. So these come from so-called dual phase models of action. So basically what this means is that there are two processes. Motivation first, followed by volition. So and that volitional phase is where motivation gets converted into actual action. Okay? And Gollwitzer, one of the sort of leading authors in this area, talks about implementation intentions, the strong effects of simple plans. So he answered the question, or tried to answer the question, of how do we furnish our intentions or our intended actions with plans or actions to achieve our goals. Okay? So you might intend to do a particular behavior, okay, to help achieve a certain goal. Okay? So I want to do physical activity so I can lose weight, for example. But you don't convert those intentions into actions. So Gollwitzer says, well, identifying situations which would cue up or prompt you to engage in that behavior is the most effective way. And if that situation or condition arises, then you're much more likely to do that behavior. So this doesn't change people's intentions. People's intentions are a prerequisite, but it strengthens the link between intentions and behavior. In other words, it helps people convert their good intentions into actual behavior. So it's really good for these strange people who are, well, not so strange, but these people who are unsuccessful intenders, the people who are most vulnerable to lapsing. So, what does an implementation intention look like? Well, it's just a way of getting people to furnish or bolster their good intentions. It's a way of getting people to plan more effectively. So it typically uses a pen and paper delivery, or it could be used online. We've used online means to get people to plan more effectively using this technique. And this is an example of a pen and paper intervention. So this could be used in any particular context. It could be used in pamphlets or leaflets. It could be used in online training. It could be used in group interventions and so forth. And basically, this is the person is usually presented with some sort of rationale, some sort of prompt. Okay, in this case, it's an example from physical activity. So you're more likely to exercise for at least 30 minutes a day, so according to guidelines. If you say when, if, and where, then you will exercise and stick to your plan. And then you ask people to write that plan down. That act of writing tends to create a memory trace, and it makes people much more effective in recalling that plan or that intention. So in this case, a business executive or a busy person, a busy office worker might say, you know, when the clock strikes a particular time, they may even set their mobile phone or some sort of app to remind them to do so, then I'll pick up my gym bag and go to the fitness center. Clearly, that's not a Finnish executive, because I know you guys eat lunch at 11:30, okay? So I've just learned that, actually. So maybe you'd have to change it for a Finnish context. But that's just an example of the kinds of planning exercises that could be used. And these have been shown to be extremely effective. Even very simple planning interventions like this, even on a one-off basis, have been shown to be effective in changing behavior. And I'll get onto some of that research a bit later. Here's some articles which have suggested the importance of implementation intentions. So that's outlined the sort of motivational, the volitional side of things. I'm going to briefly talk a little bit about implicit motivation, because this is a more recent innovation within the area of social psychology, health psychology, and education. So this is a suggestion that people's deep-seated underlying beliefs, which they're not really aware of, impacts on their behavior. And it's a relatively recent addition to research in the area of social cognition and motivation. And the suggestion is that individuals hold beliefs and motives that are not accessible consciously. They're stored knowledge structures. So they sit in your memory, and they're schematic in nature. Okay? So once activated, they lead to certain behavioral patterns. Okay? So they can be made activated by certain contexts or cues. Okay? So that example that I gave earlier about smoking, that's an example of cues which will lead people to enact their behavior. And many smokers talk of finding themselves smoking without actually realizing that they've, taken a cigarette out of the box, out of the packaging, lit the cigarette, and taken a drag. They don't realize that process is actually relatively non-conscious. It's not unconscious, because they don't do it in their sleep, but it's non-conscious. So their level of awareness is zero or very minimal, okay? And actually, that's an adaptive. That's something which is evolutionary adaptive. The reason why we have these automatic processes is because over time, in order to free up processing space, in order to free up our memory so that we can deal with complex actions and complex situations in our everyday life, we have adapted to automate and to make our, many of the mundane actions that we do automatic and non-conscious. Okay, and that makes sense. It makes sense because it enables us to so that we don't have to weigh up the pros and the cons, the benefits and the detriments of every behavior that we do. And so these impact our action. These kinds of beliefs impact action beyond awareness. And a lot of this research originated in the areas like prejudice. Okay, so there's quite a lot of research looking at implicit attitudes in racism, sexism, and so forth. But those methods have since been applied in a health behavior and a behavior change context. So there you go. I've given the examples. Lighting a cigarette, decisions to exercise tend to be automatic. And there is research showing that these effects are pervasive. So implicit measures using decision tasks which get people to associate stimuli related to the behavior and a positive and negative response demonstrated, that's how you measure implicit attitudes, have shown medium-sized effects on behavior. So using these kinds of computerized measures, researchers are able to measure implicit attitudes and show how they impact on behavior. And we've done that. So here's an example that actually implicit or automatic motives impact on health behavior above and beyond the more deliberative motives and beliefs that we typically use when trying to understand and predict health behavior. So this probably means that there's, for some people, some health behaviors are queued up naturally and that they are determined by their underlying beliefs. Okay? Changing people's automatic beliefs may prove challenging because they're underlying, they've been learned over a period of time, and therefore they're very resistant to change, but not impossible. So, I've outlined some of these processes within this integrated model. Motivational, volitional, this planning aspect, and now the implicit aspect. For the last 10 minutes, I'm going to outline some of the attempts that we have done and other people have done to try and change these factors. So this is some examples of some interventions which have been evaluated within a research context, but could easily be translated into a practical context to change behavior. So one way we can change behavior is by changing motivation. So these factors, the attitudes, intrinsic motivation, and perception of control, which we've identified as strongly related to intentions and behavior, these are factors that we should be able to change. Okay. So this is some research from a very similar model to the integrated behavior change model called the transcontextual model. And really you can see that there are very similar elements to the integrated behavior change model. And this, the sort of rationale behind this model is that that educational contexts, in this case a physical educational context, teaching within those contexts to promote autonomous motivation should lead to autonomous motivation for activities outside of the school context. So this is, we call it the transcontextual model because promoting motivation in an educational context should lead to motivation outside of school. And this is one of the clear goals of education. Clear goals of education is that students will take teaching and take things that they've learned, skills and knowledge that they've learned, and apply it in out of school or leisure time context. In this case, it's promoting autonomous motivation towards physical activity outside of school, within a school classroom context, and how that impacts on motivation, attitudes, intentions to do physical activity outside of school. So it's called the transcontextual model. And actually, one of the places where we've applied this is actually in a higher education context. So we've got quite a lot of data looking at the physical education context, and that's been supported. So there are some examples below. But we've also applied this in a higher education context. So this is a recent article by Derwin Chan, a PhD, former PhD student of mine, and colleagues. And we demonstrated that perceived autonomy support, so perceptions that a lecturer in a higher education context, in higher education lessons, so seminars and lectures, will promote autonomous motivation, so self-determined motivation, in class, but also outside of class, after lecture. And this is their attitudes, beliefs, and intentions to engage in after-lecture learning, to reinforce their learning, so basically more self-directed learning. And we found significant relations between these factors, particularly autonomous motivation, and on their actual studying or out-of-lecture behavior. So that supports this sort of suggested motivational content and this motivational sequence. That implies that promoting autonomous motivation will change behavior. And the way in which autonomous motivation is promoted is through providing choice, providing positive feedback, developing a meaningful rationale, adopting a questioning or didactic approach, setting personal goals, and promoting better control. And so basically encourage self-directed motivation. And here's a test of that model using training to promote autonomous motivation within teachers. So this is just a PATH model representing an intervention where we train teachers to be more autonomy supportive. And that training led to increased perceived autonomy support and intrinsic motivation, which impacted on children's attitudes and intention to engage in behavior. And this is in a physical education, physical activity context. And we could also perhaps intervene at other stages in this integrated model. So we could not only promote motivation, but we could also promote action planning. So for example, this is some research from colleagues at Leeds University, where they used a planning intervention and also a motivational intervention. They gave people a decisional balance sheet, which is getting them to write down the positive aspects and the benefits for engaging in physical activity behavior. And they also gave them a manipulation for implementation intentions, a planning intervention. So very similar to the planning intervention that I outlined earlier, that if I do this particular behavior, then I will, if this particular context arises, then I will do this particular behavior. So they used a 2x2 design and an experimental design. And these are, very briefly, the results. So this was their attendance to gyms, okay, their gym attendance. And they found that both participants who received both an implementation intention and a decisional balance, so this motivational and planning intervention, were much more likely to attend the gym. Okay, so their gym attendance was the proxy measure of their physical activity behavior. Now, of course, we don't know what they did in the gym, okay? But we assume that they weren't just sitting in the sauna. They were actually doing some physical activity. Maybe they went to the sauna later. But the bottom line is that they were together, both a motivational and a planning intervention resulted in more physical activity, more gym attendance. We've done the same. In a context of promoting or reducing binge drinking and alcohol intake in students, okay, in undergraduate students. Big problem in the UK, big problem in Australia, big problem in Finland, I think. And so clearly this has impact both on the health of the student, on their potential and risk for, you know, breaking an arm, for example, so injury, and also it has an impact on their studies and an impact on costs, hospital costs, cost of policing, those kinds of things. So reducing alcohol intake in undergraduate students is clearly an important desirable behavior. So we found that a motivational intervention, in this case visualizing the benefits of reducing alcohol intake, and a planning intervention, so planning alternatives to drinking in particular contexts, impacted on alcohol intake. And these negative relationships shows that, you know, with high motivation and more planning, people are less likely to engage in the behavior. Most importantly, we found that when participants received both, they were much more likely to reduce their alcohol intake. So it's an alcohol intervention in the context, in an educational context. So finally, one possible intervention target would be changing implicit motivation. And in this case, it's a very experimental study, but it has implications for practice. The research is primed by providing examples, implicitly delivered examples, of dieting and fattening food versus a control condition. Okay, So participants were then asked to recognize diet in a decision task, so an online task. And they were also asked to choose between a healthy, so a piece of fruit, or an unhealthy, a chocolate bar, parting gift. And those participants who received the implicitly presented messages for fattening foods, but also diet foods, were much faster at recognizing the word diet. So it seemed to activate their implicit motive towards healthy eating, and also were more likely to choose the healthy option as a parting gift, okay, relative to controls. So it shows that we can, by structuring the environment or providing implicit messages, such as posters and things, we can change people's implicit attitudes. Just to summarize. So I've presented this integrated behavior change model. And the suggestion, and this synthesizes research from various models, and the suggestion is that behavior change is a function of motivation, volition, and automatic processes. And theory-based interventions are more likely to be successful because they provide evidence-based, systematic approaches to understanding health behavior, and it also provides an opportunity to understand why our interventions might work. And those interventions could promote health in numerous contexts, particularly educational contexts. And I've given a couple of examples of a school-based and a higher education-based interventions using these kinds of strategies. Of course, interventions needs the selection of the kinds of intervention techniques will depend on the population, who you're trying to change, the context, and also the mode of delivery. But many of these techniques can be incorporated in those different intervention styles, the different modes of intervention that I outlined earlier. For example, anything from written communication to online campaigns to one-on-one behavior change efforts between a leader and a group of people. I'd like to thank my colleagues for all of their contributions. They did all the hard work for which I'm now taking credit. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Martin. I think we have to keep our schedule, so if you want to ask any questions, you can go and see Martin later during these days. But on the behalf of the organizing committee, we want to thank you, and here is something for your welfare at work and at home.
Thank you.